With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to this week's Pingdom.com Norwich City podcast, and we are looking back on a very, very eventful 3-1 home defeat to Manchester United for Norwich City on Sunday. Sorry, we're coming to you a little bit later than normal, but that Sunday 4:30 kickoff time has slightly thrown us out of whack. I am your usual host, Dave Freezer, and I am joined by a couple of River Enders, let's say. Ian Clark, who still sits in the top tier. Connor Southwell, who used to sit in the bottom tier, but is now alongside me and Paddy in the press box, of course. Gents, how are you? Clarky, how was the five-a-side this week?
Not too bad. We won 5-2, which was pretty decent. So it's a
any
new
good saves.
There was a couple. Yeah, I was I've knackered another finger. I think that's four out of the 10 fingers are now currently nursing injuries. But I refuse to retire. So, but it was good to get a win in.
Connor, are you much of a footballer when it comes to out on the pitch? I've never seen you play.
That might not be a bad thing. I was okay. I'm probably better when I was younger than the when I grew up. I had no pace, which is
when you were younger. You weren't too nearly 50, mate.
I had no pace, so that was my issue. I could get away with that but when I was about 9.
That's why I banged goal.
Yeah, it's a good shout. But no, I had a little stint at Cambridge United.
Really?
That was about the height of my football career. But no, not too bad.
Okay, lads.
I once played abroad, you know. Kick around in Turkey was a great fun.
There you go, learn something new every day, don't you? Do stay tuned as well. We've got a competition for you. Don't often have one of those on the podcast, but it is a cracker. You may well have noticed that, well, I hope you noticed anyway, that me and Connor went along to our first Norwich City sticker book swap shop, which was held at the club's fan hub in Gerald Intersport in the city centre last week. Had a chat with Ben Godfrey and Todd Cantwell, and while we were there, we thought we'd get them to sign their stickers. So we have got two to give away. We're going to split them up. So two winners. One will get a Todd Cantwell signed sticker for their album, and one will get a signed Ben Godfrey sticker. So that'll be in part two. We've got a teaser for you to answer, and the answers will come in by email if you would. But we will crack on with the game to start with. And that 3-1 defeat to Man United, we'll try not to talk too much VAR, but obviously we are going to have to cover that. But Clarkey, in terms of the performance overall and the result, can Norwich sort of quibble too much with the outcome?
No, we were second best in every area. For me, it's just really disappointing to feel so flat after a game against United. Clearly the City game was huge and brilliant and everything else, but in the past, if we've lost to Man United, it's normally we've given it a good go, we've been beaten by a better team, but we've given it a decent crack. I just felt from the start, we went on it. We were overrun in the middle, defensively, naive quite a lot of the time. I think if it hadn't been for a certain Dutch gloveman, we'd have been nursing a really, really bad defeat.
Yeah, an inspired performance from Tim Krul, wasn't it, Connor? Could it have been 5 or 6 if it wasn't for Tim, or is that a little bit unfair on the outfield players?
No, I don't think it is. I think it could have been quite easily a scoreline that was a lot heavier than the one it ended up being. I don't know if Tim Krul's been watching you play, Clarkie, but there was
<I don't. laughs>
that first save from Martial was incredible. One of the best I've seen in the flesh, I think. And then, of course, the two penalty saves as well, where he was so theatrical in the build-up. I'm amazed he didn't get a yellow card. But no, Norwich owe him a lot, because that result could easily have... Well, you're looking at 3 goals more, really, aren't you, from those opportunities? So we could be sat here talking about a 6-1 defeat rather than a 3-1-1. So, yeah, they've got a lot to thank Tim Krul for, and I think they'll be hoping that injury isn't too bad.
Yeah, of course, him and Amadou colliding as they tried to prevent Martial making it 3-0, but both just ended up limping away with knee injuries. Amadou finishing the game up front, or loosely up front, just sort of trying to make a nuisance of himself, wasn't he? And you could see there was a moment with where Krul was inhibited when it was Fred, wasn't it, went round him, and thankfully Tetti had got back to cover because Krul just couldn't get down, could he? He was not moving well. But while we were in the stadium after the game, you know, after interviews, filming our videos, bits and pieces, I did see Tim walk past on his way out of the stadium. He didn't look to be limping too badly, so we will wait and see. We might have to wait until Friday for a full update on that from Daniel Farke's pre-match press conference ahead of the Brighton trip on Saturday, but we're hoping we might be able to get a little bit of news ahead of that, but we'll see. Everyone will very much have their fingers crossed for that one, won't they?
I guess if you had an injury like that, every time you feel anything in an area, and clearly the ACL he had in his knee was horrendous, so I suppose once he went down with a niggle, he would have been concerned, and then clearly the club would have been concerned. So I guess they may, hopefully, be a bit over cautious.
For him as well, I mean, that's a major, as you sort of alluded to there, it's a major injury he had at Newcastle, and he's almost had to rebuild his career after that. So for him to suffer that a second time round would be pretty devastating for him mentally, you think, given he spoke after promotion about the dark place he'd been in. So, I think everyone's hoping that isn't as bad as first feared, because it really would put the cherry on top of the cake of what has been an awful injury situation, I think. And that's the last thing Norwich can do with at the moment, given where they are and where their confidence is at the moment, I think.
Well, while we're on the subject then, say worst case scenario, Tim Krul is ruled out for Brighton. Hopefully, even if that was the case, we're not talking anything major. Do you bring Ralph Fairman straight back in, given that he's been recovering from a groin injury, or do you go with Michael McGovern, given that he had a bit of recent action?
I'd go McGovern. Yeah. I think Farmer's a better keeper, but I think the point you make is right, that McGovern's had more recent experience playing, and probably a less of a risk, which we can't really afford at the moment.
Yeah, I think he did play for Northern Ireland in the Czech Republic as well, didn't he? So he has got that bit of recent action. I think, if I remember rightly off the top of my head, McGovern was in goal for the 5-0 at Brighton, though. which was obviously a horrible day when Russell Martin came out really pumped up after the game. It was a humiliation under Alex Neil, really, wasn't it? It was a real horrible day. But the same for you, Connor. Would you go with Michael McGovern?
No, I think I'd go for Fearman, in fairness. I just think that's what Farke will do, given that they spent a fair whack of a loan fee on him, and he seems to be back in training. So I think even if he's 90% there, that they'd rather go with him, given that they pretty much played him with one leg at Crystal Palace, albeit that he came off after 20 minutes. And I think given how McGovern played in possession of the football, I think that really didn't help Norwich's game at all. So I think I'd lean more towards Ralph Fearman than Michael McGovern.
That sounded like a bit of a character assassination there, didn't it? Oh yeah, he was in the fight, not from you, from me.
Oh, right, okay.
Just reminding people he was in goal. I'm pretty sure I am right in saying that. I haven't double checked it, but I'm not saying that we could blame that 5-0 defeat squarely on Michael McGovern, clearly, but let's just hope that Krul's injured and that we don't have to cross that bridge. Let's do it then. VAR, video assistant referee. Are they an assistant referee, or are they just the referee in these instances now?
Well, I think they are. They seem to be. They are totally removed, and there doesn't seem to be any discussion. It's a bit like, we are going to review it, and we've made this decision. You know, up yours, ref. And even though I sit at the top of the River End, when James went down, we could see the ref clearly, you know, couldn't have been clearer with his no penalty, waved his arms in the way that they do, and he basically said, no way was it a penalty.
I'm having some trouble with the connection.
We've got a fourth guest in the room.
Sorry, it's not me.
Someone's Siri's joining in the conversation.
My very Australian series.
Maybe it's VAR overruling our pod. But no, so he couldn't have been clearer, could he, that it wasn't a penalty. And the game carried on, didn't it? And all of a sudden, someone decides that it was. And I don't know, I just think it's crazy. And it's to me, it's just ruining live football. Connor, as you wrote in your very good column, that it's just taken away what should be happening. You know, refs should be in charge. If they need some help, that's absolutely fine. But just to take decision making away from them just seems wrong.
You compare it to rugby and the common sense approach of that. I think everyone knows I'm pretty keen on my rugby. You probably saw my tweets after Saturday's game. But you look at that and there are various different situations. You know, they can just say try or no try and pretty much put it on the TMO to make the decision, or the referee watches it on the big screen. Yeah. And while we were all stood there waiting to find out whether that was going to be a penalty, this first one, when Dan James and Godfrey had come together, the referee has stood there next to Norwich and Man United players with a massive big screen in front of him with just a big purple graphic saying VAR decision pending. Yeah. Why can't you show it on the big screen so the referee can see it? You know, how big is that screen?
Absolutely.
He literally could be watching the same thing that the VAR are seeing so that they make that decision together. And frankly, this one, I mean, I have no problem with them going to a VAR check on this one because I am a fan of VAR and I think that once the problems with it are ironed out, it will benefit the game. And I think it already has. I think it's just becoming an easy thing for people to go on about every week after every game. If there's a VAR decision, people go, oh, VAR's ruining the game. I don't think that's true at all. But this was the wrong decision. They looked at it and made the wrong call. Going to VAR in that, you know, in real time, when they came together, I wasn't certain. So fair enough. It's a penalty decision. It goes to VAR. But from there, for somebody to have looked at replays for a minute and get to what has pretty universally been agreed was the wrong decision is ridiculous, isn't it?
And wasn't it 2.5 minutes, the whole thing?
Was it 2.5? Well, didn't seem as long as that to me.
Well, some of the others over the weekend were that long. So
yeah, it was about 2.5 minutes, which when you consider they had, 3 minutes added on at the end of the half, there's a case to say that they didn't really factor that into things, given there was, two penalties, two major VAR calls that took probably about 3 minutes and then any time for stoppages as well. So there's that aspect of it. I've got a few problems with it. I think I'm pro VAR, but probably anti how they're currently using it. I think I probably sit in between both camps at the moment, because I think fundamentally, and I get the rugby comparisons, but from what I've seen of rugby, I'm not a massive fan, so I'm sure you'll correct me. The game seems a little bit more stop-starty, although
yeah, it is.
So maybe there's a bit more of a license for those stoppages in play. But I think fundamentally, we've got to remember where VAR has come from, and that's from managers every week coming out post-match and just absolutely hammering referees whether those decisions have been correct or not in retrospect, and so they've almost tried to deflect the criticism from referees and place them onto a situation where they are trying to help them fundamentally. But all you've got now is, as we saw on Sunday, the case where a referee is making a decision, he's perfectly positioned, makes the right call, we're then looking at video for 2 minutes. The crowd inside the stadium are frustrated because they don't know what's going on. They don't know what the referee's saying to the VAR official and vice versa. So that conversation is happening. You've then got players getting frustrated. The game becomes a farce, really, because there's just this lull in play that is unneeded. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer actually summed it up quite well, where he went, if you're looking at a decision for 2 or 3 minutes, then realistically it's not in the clear and obvious aspect of it. But then equally you've got the subplot of we've had 100 games I think with VAR in prior to this weekend. There was no overturn penalties and no red cards, and then after this weekend I think there was 4 overturns, so they've lowered that bar and seem not to have told anyone.
Right.
So then that communication aspect of it again, which I think fundamentally it comes down to, is blurred because supporters don't know what the threshold is, players are confused because suddenly clear and obvious errors are now going under a different definition. And so it all becomes a bit clouded. And then when you add to that the goodness knows why they're not using the pitch side monitors, but there has to be some leadership on that, because for me, if I'm a referee making a decision, it helps me sell a decision a lot more if I'm going over, and it makes me look like I have the final say on it. I'll use the comparison, it's kind of vague, but if you think of a sporting director at a football club, certainly in Norwich's aspect, you have him and then you have the head coach. If you've got a sporting director saying, I want to sign this player, and the head coach doesn't have a say in it, then that doesn't end up well, right? So we've kind of got a situation where we've got a referee refereeing from 140 miles away when the initial referee made the correct decision at the time, we're just reaching that decision far later. I almost wonder if we need to strip it back and almost work on certain things at certain times. So almost have this season dedicated to improving offsides and making sure they're slick and introducing it like that. But what the solution is, I don't know. But if it carries on in its current form, then it's going to make watching football, certainly for supporters, very difficult, I think.
And the Arsenal one, where the goal at the end got disallowed, I mean, I thought that was a wrong decision because, if anything, the Arsenal lad was pushed, which would have led to a penalty. But then VAR ruled the goal out because it claimed that the Arsenal player had made a foul. So, and that took couple of minutes, didn't it? And the joy of that last minute winner was just all ripped away.
That one's too picky, isn't it? The Arsenal one, yeah. Was it Callum Chambers?
Well, there was loads going on. Everyone was fouling everyone, and you know the ref just in that case, you think you'd have to let it go on. If you've got loads of fouls going on from different people, which then meant there was a goal. Mm. So that was a shambles.
They've still got a referee like they're on the pitch. The VAR still has to think about it. That. You know how it was in real time. Nobody at that Arsenal game was saying that goal should have been left out, ruled out because of that. And I think if we come on to the second one with the Todd Cantwell handball, elbow ball type one, by the laws of the game, that is handball. They've got that right, haven't they? By slowing it down in super slow motion to see whether he was just inside the area. The referee had missed it, but I suppose Fred had put a shot on goal. That may well have been going on target. It may well have gone into the net. So if a defender's arm in an unnatural position stops the ball from going towards a goal, then all right, that is probably a penalty. So I don't think anyone's got too many issues with that. Are you both pretty much the same on that?
No, I think the second case is actually a stronger case for why VAR is needed, because I think the right decision was reached. It took a bit more time, but I think eventually they got the right decision. And unlike the first one, it wasn't a case of if he'd handled it, it was a case of seeing whether or not he was in the box. So that one I can understand a bit more. But again, supporters didn't know that was the case. They didn't really know what they were checking for, because particularly if you were sitting in the Barclay, you see a load of bodies going to block a football, and then you see a corner given, and then you see the finger on the ear. And the only time we see that TV signal is if they're overturning the decision. Now, for me, that needs to be the decision to let everyone in the stadium know that VAR is being used, as opposed to just placing one finger on the ear, which, if you're sat at the top of the River End, like Clark is, that's incredibly hard to see. So, for me, it just comes down to communication. I don't think they've got it quite right at the moment.
And if they've got confidence in decision-making, why not show the video? Like when you're on match day, you see all the repeats, don't you? Well, show that live, you know. And if they don't want to do that, it means they're not confident in their decisions.
But it comes back to, if you're at home watching it on TV, you get to see the replays, you get to see what's going on, and those in the stadium don't. So it's almost they're being put, those in the stadium and those who are paying the money to go to the games are being put secondary to those TV audiences.
Oh, definitely, VAR does that.
Absolutely, and this is, again, a massive part of it. Is it being brought in for the right reasons, or is it being brought in to enhance the experience for those watching in the Premier League abroad? At the moment, I think there's an argument to say that it's not being brought in for the right reasons.
Yeah, because when you watch a game as a neutral, like we did a lot of the World Cup, for instance, you see VAR and you love the drama, don't you? When you see Ronaldo there looking shifty, thinking, oh, am I going to get sent off for this? Mm. Everyone loves the drama of it, don't they? But when it's your team and you have two penalties given against you, you're anti-VAR, aren't you?
So Tottenham, Manchester City in the Champions League, another great example. Wow. We were all watching that going, oh, this is great, and yet in reality for those supporters in the ground, it was probably just amusement, wasn't it?
Yeah, so, Tottenham were so lucky with that. It's ridiculous. That would have been a much better final, no doubt, if absolutely. Man City got through as well. But beyond all that, then, let's park VAR, because everybody gets sick and tired of it, frankly, don't they? But strangely, VAR isn't involved for some reason in the Premier League, have decided to check that goalkeepers are on the lines.
Yeah.
And as brilliant as Tim Krul did to save penalties, he was well off his line for both of those penalties. I said it in real time, didn't I, Connor? Yeah. You know, the referee should be watching that.
And the linesman.
It's ridiculous. And, you know, he should have got yellow cards for time wasting. If that had been an away goalkeeper in front of the Barclay acting like that before a penalty, people would have wanted to lynch him. They would have been going absolutely bonkers, wouldn't they, in the Barclay? So it's a ridiculous game sometimes, isn't it? But, you know, all we can say is that they were two good saves. We know that Tim Krul is very good at reading them. He of course, came in the World Cup 2014 quarterfinal against Costa Rica for Holland. Saved two penalties to take them through to the semi-final. So it's something that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer praised him for after the game. But it was more than that, wasn't it? It was the other saves that were so crucial. So it's funny to think that at this point that his status as number one was even under question in the summer, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, there was one early on, which you say, with his leg, wasn't it? Clearly there was a Martial one. There was another one in the second half with his legs.
Greenwood.
So that's five top draw save. I thought the second penalty particularly was a great save, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I just think that the way that he's clearly a leader, the way he's with other players, and the way he's with the crowd, you know, and it's just so annoying that the momentum we got from those two saves on both occasions pretty quickly we threw away just by sort of naivety and just not reading the game properly.
Yeah, well, just to look at the stats, I didn't make a note of them. United had 21 shots and 11 on target. You know, that can't continue. That's been that. It was the same with Villa, same with Man City, same with Chelsea, wasn't it? That there was a lot of shots conceded. 54% possession, 10 corners to Norwich's one. So I think if those stats don't tell you that United deserved it, then you're looking at it through very much yellow and green glasses. There was a high to finish on, at least. You know, the mood at one point was feeling like we were going to be leaving Carrow Road feeling very drab. But thankfully, O'Neill Hernandez was brought on at half time alongside Marco Stiepermann. They replaced Cantwell and Leitner. Daniel Farker reacted to the situation. Pleased to see that, Connor, in terms of Daniel making positive changes. I mean, for me, Leitner just did not work at all.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that experiment with Leitner didn't work really at Bournemouth. I think he's probably in the side as a matter of association with that result, as opposed to perhaps his individual contribution. But no,
he was better at Bournemouth than he was against United.
Yeah, he was
almost anonymous against United.
He was very, I think, floaty was the word I used to you at the time, just sort of in between what Norwich were doing defensively and not getting close enough to Pukki to influence things. So he was kind of he wasn't really doing much, to be honest, and it was a bit of a passenger. And when you're in that situation, you're always going to be targeted as the one to come off to try and change things, which I think O'Neill Hernandez did. Injected something that Norwich haven't had in a long time, and that's pace. Spoke after Bournemouth and said the numerous times they had opportunities to go on counter-attacks at Dean Court and just didn't quite have the pace to bring the ball over the halfway line with any real intent. But it was also nice to see someone get quite close to Pukki. I mean, we saw throughout that second half, he was pretty much pushed up on the halfway line, which placed a massive onus on Jamal Lewis, who was obviously ill, and then Sam Byron when he came on to be defensively resilient. But Norwich had to chase the game at that point. And considering he was against Wan-Bissaka, who I think is an excellent defender, I thought he made a real nuisance of himself. It would have been quite nice to see him down the right and having a go at Ashley Young, because for me, that's where United felt most vulnerable.
If you're a defender, what don't you want? You know, a strong, quick, direct, aggressive, talented striker running at you and causing a nuisance and doing something a bit different and being tricky. So I think he to me was, well, Krul was clearly the man of the match, but Hernandez was the only other probably positive thing from Saturday. And he's got to be a starter for Brighton now, because that's what we now need to do to inject that life back into our attacking play, which has been a bit lacking in the last few games.
I think I saw the stat that Wan-Bissaka made 11 tackles in the game, and that was the joint most of any player in a Premier League game so far this season. Yeah. And Hernandez also made more dribbles, I think it was 9, or attempted more dribbles, which I think it was 9, than any other player on the pitch. And he was only obviously on the pitch for half the time. Yeah. So, a positive at the very least. And before we come on to his goal, let's just hear a little bit from O'Neill. Very enthusiastic guy to speak to, always very happy. But he, of course, was asked about being the first Cuban to score a goal in the Premier League, which he was very proud about. So here is a little bit from O'Neill Hernandez.
I was dreaming since I was a kid about the Premier League, about the first league, and it's the best league in the world. And to score that goal, it's incredible, and I'm happy and proud for that. And yeah, we have to keep going on and work hard for more. That's incredible. I think I have later a lot of messages from a lot of Cubans. I'm proud for that.
Tim Krul, have you ever seen a keeper make two penalties?
I told him before when I was in a cold bath and I saw him, and I said to him, man, I never saw a goalkeeper holding two penalties in a game. And then I say to him, how we can lose this game? Normally we have to win and shoot them here outside the stadium. This was incredible, really. I'm so proud of him. He is so good, man. Really like that.
Shows his character as well, the way he was whipping up the crowd before.
Exactly. That's Tim Krul, and that's why we like him how he is.
And yes, it was O'Neill with the goal, and it was a decent individual finish. I mean, I thought Scott McTominay had actually been excellent for United, far better than I thought he was. But then O'Neill just shows that determination. And if Wan-Bissaka hadn't played as well, he could have had a much bigger impact on the game, couldn't
he? Absolutely. You know, and he forced the error, didn't he? And that's what, you know, we can say it came from a mistake, but the mistake was forced. And it was hardly a tapping, was it? He ran, I don't know how many people he ran past, but and the directness he had, and a great finish in the corner. I mean, you know, we know De Gea is a decent keeper, and there wasn't much of a gap there for him to get through, but he positioned it really well. So, yeah, thought he was really good.
He went close with another one, whether it was just wide, didn't he? At any point, sat in the crowd, Clarke, did you feel like this could be on? The comeback might just be possible?
I think if, you know, in a bizarre way, if we'd have got one more, you know, quickly, you don't know. And we've seen these Sterling comebacks at Carrow Road a lot. And there was a bloke actually who sat near us who shouldn't have been there, was actually a United fan, someone had let him in. And I could hear him talking, and he was a bit worried, because when we were starting to go forward, you could tell that, I suppose, they've had a lot of insecurities and doubts this season. And I think if we could have got another one, but we didn't, so we unfortunately didn't. but I think Hernandez does give us a bit of hope now that we can start getting some goals and making a danger in the opposition half.
But Carrow wasn't too bad. Well, you know, it wasn't like Norwich were booed off or anything, was it? And United showed their true colours, showed that their position in the table was false, which you could have predicted ahead of kickoff, really. They turned up, didn't they? And they're players that we all know are, you know, how much is Marcus Rashford worth? 100 million. Martial, probably not too far from that if he actually is in form. Dan James is proving to be a real good signing. They've got a lot of top quality. But I didn't feel, as we left the stadium, or certainly as the fans left the stadium, that the mood was too bad. Worried, of course, but it wasn't totally negative, was it?
No, I don't think it was. I think it was a little bit disappointing in terms of the way the crowd reacted when Norwich went 1-0 down. I think from there it felt quite resigned after quite a good start. And I don't know if it's just reflective of where Norwich are at the moment or perhaps the way performances are going, but I think most supporters in reality probably knew that this was going to be a tough season, there was going to be challenges, and that they would do very, very well to stay up, given the squad they have, given it was a squad that was predicted not to get out of the Championship, let alone to stay in the Premier League, and they've not massively improved it, given or signed tons of players like Aston Villa have, so that expectation isn't there. And they're going to need the fan base, and to me it just felt a little bit flat, and I don't know if it's because of Manchester City and the hangover of that, and everyone's talking about how they need to replicate that. For me, they need to almost put that in a box and forget about it. For now, it's about making sure they get themselves back on the straight and narrow, because, I mean, you read the stats out there, 20 shots they're conceding in regular sort of intervals in certain games. And that's a massive concern, because if those statistics keep up, then they're not going to stay in the Premier League. And the best we saw Norwich defensively was when they had the crowd on their side. Manchester City and Bournemouth stick out that second half. The fans were excellent. So, yeah, I don't think the mood was terrible. I kind of felt like there was a bit of expectation, which was quite funny given who the opponents were. But I think that's the discussion around Manchester United at the moment. But, yeah, I was a little bit disappointed with the crowd, to be honest.
Okay. Oh, well, just to finish before we look ahead to the games to come and Brighton on Saturday, there was it was supposed to be a moment's silence for Duncan Forbes, of course, club icon. I think you can safely use that word, can't you? Of course, he was well before mine and Connor's time. So I honestly felt a little bit useless last week because I couldn't really comment too much. I'd never even interviewed Duncan because obviously he'd been ill for quite a long time before he sadly passed away last week in his late 70s. But it was due to be a moment silence, and it ended up being a hearty round of applause, didn't it, Clarke? So sad, but a nice send off.
Yeah, I think it was spontaneous, the applause, because I sensed that when the stadium announcer was going through the 33 years he'd been with the club, all the years he'd played, the appearances and all of that sort of stuff, I think people sort of almost like wanted to applaud that, and then it led into that was what it was going to become rather than a silence.
Yeah.
And I mean, I must admit, I think Duncan clearly was known for his vocality and you know, the big voice. So to me, it was actually probably a bit more apt than if it had been. And I always fear with the silence, you're always going to get a couple of idiots who start making noise, and other people try and drown them out. So I think actually it was in a lot of ways it was a good thing to do, and it was a great spectacle, you know, to see him off, and the banners that were in the Barclay and that fantastic picture that was on the screen. I think it all worked out really well, and as a fitting tribute to him.
Yeah, he was one of my dad's favourite players when he was growing up. So I often heard a lot about Duncan and about the, you know, how much of a leader he was, and you know, a tough centre back and things like that. And I think growing up, that I was sort of Malky Mackay was pointed at a little bit in terms of he's that type. He was that type of mould.
Yeah.
Is that a sort of fair comparison?
Absolutely.
Almost.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you know, we'll say about Duncan, the ball got past him, the man got past him, and they were both. So you know, so many great stories about, you know, his leadership, his strength. You know, so I think somebody told me that Kevin Keegan has said he was the toughest opponent he ever played against, which. If that's true, says a lot, because obviously Keegan came up against some pretty brutal centre halves. But no, he was that proper Scottish, you know, cut from granite, no messing around. You know, his voice, you know, you did hear it in Yarmouth, as so many people have said.
From true crime to football, Brexit to folklore. For more great podcasts from Archant, head to audioboom.com/channel/Archant.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, just a quick bit of housekeeping then. If you are interested in sponsoring the Pinken podcast, then please do get in touch with matt.withers@archant.co.uk. This is your podcast as much as it is ours, so if you ever want to get in touch with us, you can email thepinken@archant.co.uk, or you know where we are on social media, and you'll need that email address in just a minute, because I'm going to come on to our competition. Which, as we trailed earlier, is a signed sticker of Todd Cantwell and a signed sticker of Ben Godfrey from the players themselves. We managed to get them to do that last week. And if you would like them for your book, for your collection, we have set you a little teaser, which hopefully isn't too easy to Google. We wanted something that wasn't something you could just go onto Soccer Base or Transfer Market or something like that and just find out. So, can you guess who this player is? I'm not going to ask you to in case you give it away, but hopefully this isn't too easy. The player was playing for Norwich in the 90s, made 87 appearances, scored 10 goals, and also played for Middlesbrough and Coventry City. If you can tell us who that player is, if you could email thepinken@archant.co.uk, or you can tweet us as well. We are @pinken. We'll also put the details on Facebook or Instagram. But we will give those away separately. So one person will get the Todd sticker, one person will get the Ben sticker. And best of luck. I hope I haven't made that too difficult. You both look a little bit perplexed. So hopefully
we get some response.
I'm sure somebody will get that. Yeah. I'll just repeat it. They played in the 1990s. They made 87 appearances for Norwich. They scored 10 goals. And they also played for Middlesbrough and Coventry. Right, we'll move on. And Brighton on Saturday, just briefly, chaps, they got a good result at home against Everton. They won 3-2, although they were perhaps a little bit fortunate with a penalty and then a Lucas Digne own goal in injury time, handing them the victory. But if you just look at their last five results, so they beat Everton 3-2 at home. They lost 2-1 at Villa. No shame, I suppose Norwich fans can say at the moment. They then, of course, won 3-0 at home against Spurs, which was an incredible result. Lost 2-0 at Chelsea, and they also drew 0-0 at Newcastle. So Graham Potter seems to be doing a pretty decent job. He showed real potential as a head coach at Swansea last year and has got a real definite style of play. And it almost after Brighton were established under Chris Hughton, they brought in some better, more attacking players, and as Norwich fans can relate to, perhaps he wasn't capable of bringing that sort of attacking style through, but Potter seems to be doing a decent job, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I did my column last week on the mini league that Norwich, I believe, are in, and the teams that they're going to have to come against to realistically stay up, and I put Brighton in that probably more out of hope than expectation. I think they'll be okay, and I think you're absolutely right. That's a really good analysis of them. It's going to be a tough game. I think clearly every game, particularly every away game, is going to be tough. And yeah, they'll be confident having beaten Everton. I know Everton aren't what they were and what they could be, but it's, you know, it's still a decent win. So we don't go to try and get a draw deliberately, but I think I'd definitely take a point.
They scored 12, conceded 14, as opposed to Norwich, who have scored 11 and conceded 24. So defensively, they've been a fair bit more solid. So the Hughton days persist slightly for them. They seem to have a decent balance. How would you like to see Norwich approach this one, Conor? Do you see Norwich as having an opportunity to maybe get back to sort of their championship best and what they are best at under Daniel Farke?
I think supporters will definitely be putting a circle around it as one they think they can get points from on the road. Brighton are a good side, actually. I think Graham Potter's actually kicked them on. I think that was always going to go one of two ways. They're either going to really struggle or they're actually going to kick on. And I think he seems to have managed to get a bit more out of the attacking players than what Chris Hughton managed, which perhaps isn't a surprise given what we saw at Carrow Road under him. But no, I think in terms of how Norwich need to approach this, I think it's about using that template from Bournemouth. And for me, and I'll keep saying it, it's about balance and that how they set up that midfield, because that's the area for me that they haven't quite got right so far this season. I mean, we sort of point at Bournemouth as the recent example where things sort of clicked, but even then, you mentioned Leitner earlier on, so it wasn't 100% there. That's where I think Hernandez could be crucial, because he could give them something different and a bit of an outlet on the left, which might take a bit of a pressure off Pukki. So, it's about balance for me. If they can almost take that template from Bournemouth and build on it and build an attacking structure, almost what we saw from that last half an hour or that half an hour in the second half where they were by far the better team. If they can do that over 90 minutes, then there's no reason why they can't get points. But it's going to, for me, it's about seeing a performance, because we haven't really seen a complete Norwich performance probably since that Manchester City game, and I think confidence has been affected by that.
I think I'll go Tribal and Tetti as the two holding midfielders, because obviously Tribal can be a little bit more attacking and set the tempo passing wise, and then I would move Kenny McLean into the number 10 role and put Leitner on the bench, because that wasn't a good enough performance on Saturday, unfortunately. It didn't work out, and we've never really seen Kenny in that position. And I just, if you're going to start O'Neill Hernandez on the left, you've then got a left footer in that position who can perhaps just thread O'Neill in behind a few times, perhaps, you know, try and get Pukki into that channel as well, maybe just focus on overloading on the left and him and Buendia on creating. But don't know. I think it's going to be tough. I think I actually predicted Brighton would go down, so it shows what I know. Although we're only 10 games into the season, it can still go wrong. You know, Norwich could still finish mid-table. They could still finish bottom quite comfortably. So, yeah, just finally, Clarkie, do you feel confident at all that Norwich are going to be able to get something from this one?
I think, you know, we keep talking about season-defining games and periods, but I think these next two games, Brighton and then Watford next week Friday, you know, if worst case scenario we lose both of those games, I think that really is looking bleak. Two good performances, Colin, you're absolutely right about we need those performances. Two good performances and some points. Then you start to think, well, maybe it's more positive as we move on. And certainly I like the idea of Tetti and Tribal. I think you need that. You need that balls in the middle. And there's plenty of creative players around them to do that. So just do a little bit of dirty stuff before we can start playing the football.
Absolutely, I think I'd go along with that. And yeah, that Watford game, that is going to be huge. You know, the Villa game, 5-1, then sent us all into a miserable international break, didn't it, to dwell on it. So let's hope whatever happens at Brighton that they can, Friday night under the lights as well, isn't it, on TV, I think, the Watford game.
Bonfire night as well, isn't it, straight after
there we go.
Fireworks.
Yeah, the fireworks are in Norwich Castle, aren't they?
Absolutely.
It's all set up. It's all set up. It's going to be a really interesting couple of weeks. Thank you very much, chats, for joining me today. Top stuff. Please do get involved in the competition. you can rewind if you need to hear the details again, but we will put them all out on social media as well. Hopefully that's a top prize for you guys to apply for, and we will catch up with you soon. Connie, you will have your terrace talk coming later in this week, won't you? And we will also, of course, have the pre-match press conference on Friday, so we'll keep it all coming your way, and fingers crossed for Brighton on Saturday. Thanks for listening.